Continuing with the explanation of how to practice yoga. Same shuchau sharkara vakni valuka vivarjite shabja jala shaya ibihi mano nukule tatu chakshu pidane guhani vata shrayanina yojayet. One should practice meditation while sitting peacefully in a place where the ground is even, clean, and free from pebbles, sand and threat of fire, away from noise and public watering places. The place should be pleasing to the mind, not distressful to see, like a windless cave. So this specific description here, where to practice meditation, what kind of environment to practice it in. It shouldn't be a place that's too high or too low. It should be a clean place. If it's not naturally clean, then one should make an effort to purify it, to clean it, before practicing meditation there. It shouldn't be too close to distractions, crowds, and other distractions. That's why it said that it's not advisable to practice, even in a holy place, even in a holy tirtha, at a place where people take bath and come to get their water, because many people congregate there and they engage in prajalta and there's a lot of distraction. It's like if you go to Keshigat, you can see the lines of beggars and all sorts of people want your money, and you know, not a very good place to sit down and try to meditate. Unless you can transcend all that. I don't want to say that. I mean, I just read. Sanatana Goswami's commentary on the Bhagavatamrita, he was just saying that the Jamuna River is a thousand times, even from the, quoting from the Purana, the Jamuna River is a thousand times more potent and sacred than the Ganga. And compared to everywhere on the Jamuna, the one place where Krishna killed Keshi is a thousand times more pure and potent. And compared to that, the place where Krishna rested after killing Keshi is a thousand times more potent. So I don't want to commit such offenses by saying that. Well, common people congregate around busy places where people take baths. And animals, wild animals, if you're in the forest and you go to a lake or a watering place, you're in danger of being attacked by wild animals because they go there too. The place where you meditate should be pleasing to the mind. Krishna describes that one should prasanatma vigata be. One should practice meditation with a peaceful mind, free from fear. So if you're in a very dangerous place, you're not going to be easily free from fear. Natu chaksha pidane. It shouldn't be distressful to the eyes. Example is given that if there are smoky lamps, torches burning, then that can cause distress to the eyes. Well, these are all the negative descriptions of where you should not meditate. What is a positive idea of where you should meditate, or where you can meditate? So one example is given. A place like a windless cave is recommended as an example. Not that everybody has to meditate in a cave, but that's an example of a suitable place. The whole purpose of finding an appropriate place is to find somewhere where you can focus and concentrate your mind. That's what's essential. The details here are just given for example of the kind of place you should look for, the kind of environment and consciousness you should begin your meditation in. So any situation where the mind can be fixed is appropriate, according to the commentators. And according to the Vedanta Sutra, as explained by Baladeva Vibhushan, commenting on the first part of the fourth chapter, Sutra number 11, the Sutra says, Yattai kagrata tatra visheshat. Where the Vedanta Sutra is describing how to sit down and meditate. And the sutra says, wherever one can concentrate, there he should practice meditation, because this is not specified. So the statement is saying, find whatever place is suitable for your peace of mind, because the scripture doesn't specify exactly what particular place. So the commentary, Govinda Bhashya, in that Baladi Vajibhushan says, wherever you can fix your mind, there you can sit down and practice meditating and worshipping Lord Hari. There are no hard and fast rules for the place and other specifications of the environment in which you should meditate. Why is it not specified? Because we don't hear in the Upanishads any specific injunction where exactly you should meditate. And there's a description in Smriti, which is actually the Varaha Purana, which says, the verse is on page, on top of page 30, you can see this verse. Tameva desham seveta tankalam tamavastitim taneva bhogam seveta manoyatva prasidati nahi deshadi dikaschid visheshak samudiritaha manapasaranartam hi deshakavari chintanam. One should take advantage of whatever place, whatever time, whatever situation, and whatever sense gratification by which the mind can be, says satisfied, I think pacified is a better word. There are no special injunctions about place and so on. And the considerations that are given to place, time, and so on are only meant for the sake of making the mind peaceful. Varaha Purana. So, someone questions. Baladeva Yerushalam continues. Someone's going to question then. We do see specific injunctions about place and so on. Like in the Shvetashvara Taro Upanishad, where it says, Same Shu Chao, Charakara, one should practice meditation while sitting peacefully in a place where the ground is even, clean, and free from pebbles, sand, and fear of fire, etc. This seems to be a very specific description of where you're supposed to meditate. And then it says you should meditate in a windless cave. That's okay. The person is questioning, well, the Shvetashvatara Upanishad thus is telling you, you should go to a holy sacred place, a particular kind of place, because that will be conducive to your liberation. So we answer, says Baladeva Vijayabhushan, yes, this is true, but if even in the holy place you find disturbances, then that holy place is not going to be suitable for your spiritual realization. And if you can, if the holy place, it's very conducive to be in a holy place. Therefore, the statement specifies mano anukule. This is the most important part of the statement. This verse from the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. It should be a place that is suitable for the mind. So, Ramanujacharya, in the original commentary that he wrote on Vedanta Sutra, he comments on the same sutra and says similarly, there's no specification in the Upanishads about place and time for meditation, other than the fact that it should be a suitable place for concentrating your mind. The statement that one should meditate in a place where there's no pebbles and not too many pebbles and no fire and ground is even and clean and so on. This specifies simply a place where you can fix your mind in concentration. It doesn't single out any particular place, because the statement is summarized. The most emphatic point in the statement is that it should be suitable for the mind. Okay, we'll go on to the next verse. Now there's some description of signs you can look for to see that you're making good progress in yoga. Text 11. Nihara dumarkani lan analanam kadyota vidyut spartika shashinam etani rupani puraksarani brahmanya bivyakti karani yoge. While practicing one's meditation on the Supreme, one will experience preliminary symptoms of progressive advancement, similar to the phenomena of fog, smoke, the sun, wind, fire, fireflies, lightning, crystal glass, and the moon. Okay, so these hints here are sort of puzzling and cryptic. They're meant to entice you. You'll, you know, when you practice yoga and start becoming successful, you'll see for yourself what this all means. But there's some explanation in the commentaries. At first, your very first realizations are like fog. Because you're still in material consciousness, your senses and intelligence are still covered by gross conceptions. So there's some glimmer of spiritual light, but it's like in a dense fog. And then, as you progress further, it becomes like smoke. There's some light, but it's not clear. Then it's like seeing the sun in the sky. There's some very vivid realization. And then, on an even higher stage, it's like combined together fire and wind. It becomes a very intense, internal, personal experience. Like warm wind blowing within one's body. And then the second line, these descriptions are not necessarily a sequence of development to higher and higher stages. These are just occasional phenomena one may experience while he's meditating. He may have momentary realizations that are hard to describe but can be hinted at by these different descriptions. Sometimes your realization seems to blaze suddenly like a fire. Sometimes it's like the sky dotted with sky at night with many fireflies dotting the sky. Sometimes it's very brilliantly effulgent, like sudden lightning. And sometimes it glimmers brilliantly like pure crystal glass. And sometimes your realization is very calming, pacifying, just like the full moon. Anyway, if you see such signs while meditating, you can know that you're beginning to approach realization of Brahman. Of course, these are very impersonal descriptions. Okay, any questions so far? It's good to try to find a suitable place and a suitable time. Mm-hmm. Time of the day makes a difference too. Not only certain places are too agitated, the motive of passion is too prominent, but certain times of the day, you know, too passionate. So the proper time and place, one should, as a matter, although there, from the absolute point of view, there are no hard and fast rules for, you know, remembering Krishna, but practically speaking, you should try to find a suitable place and time. Especially if you don't have a lot of extra time for reading. You can't spend 5 hours a day reading. You may have a half an hour, 1 hour. You've got to try and find the best hour in the best place that you can and take full advantage of it. Well, when the mode of goodness is prominent, that's the best time for meditating. Well, early in the morning is the best time. But practically it depends on your own schedule. Just like, you know, in the material world, when a man comes home from work, he usually just sits down and turns on the television set. Because he doesn't feel like he's been working very hard, passionately, and now he's tired. So, you know, he doesn't feel like straining his brain at that time. So like that, you know, when you're tired and exhausted, it's not always the best time to have to try to focus your attention. You know, before going to sleep, you can read a Krishna book, but I wouldn't read something very difficult to understand when you're maybe too tired. Well, it's an obligation that has to be done, even if you can't do it perfectly. You can't avoid it. I mean, noon Gayatri has to be chanted somewhere around noon, you know, give or take an hour. So you just have to try to put aside everything for a few minutes, best you can. At least. Maybe a little bit. Prabhupada did not emphasize, although, you know, Brahmins sometimes calculate very exactly according to the movement of the sun. They do it exactly a different time every day. They change it by 4 minutes every day. But Prabhupada did not emphasize that. He said sometime around, you know, the junctures of the day. You should consider the daylight saving time, then you have to consider what's the real time. When the daylight saving time is in effect, then noon is actually at 1 o'clock. And if, because the way time zones are set up, you may be living in a place where the local time is not really the clock time, maybe 15 minutes off or more. Especially in India, where they have the same time zone across the country. So you can figure that out through some calculation, you know, what is actual noon. Anyway, chanting Gayatri is important. Gayatri is means by which we attain liberation. And you know, a liberated soul can engage in pure devotional service. So we should try to give it attention. Find somehow. Run away from everything for a few minutes, if you can.
You just remarked that those phenomena that this described here were rather impersonal.
Well, yes. I mean, just to say that, you know, realization of the Supreme looks like fireflies and crystal glass, that's not a very full description of what Krishna consciousness is.
But this speaks about the preliminary symptoms.
Yes.
That means, as a devotee, our preliminary symptoms can be also of a rather impersonal form, like that type of becoming peaceful or
we can consider that when you start chanting Hare Krishna, you experience in the first couple of weeks, you experience very definitely freedom from anxiety. If you had any anxiety before, it goes away to a good extent, and your intelligence becomes clearer. So these are preliminary symptoms of chanting Hare Krishna. I wouldn't call that impersonal. The process of meditational yoga is more impersonal. It doesn't involve having relationships with other people. You go and sit in a cave by yourself, and you see things inside yourself. It's impersonal in the sense it doesn't involve reciprocation with other people. Until you become advanced to the point that you see the super soul within you. Until then, you're just sitting in the dark by yourself. The goal is the same, but the process is much more impersonal than devotional service. Devotional service, you come, you live in an ashram, and you have to constantly deal with other people. And you have to learn how to relate to Vaishnavas and serve Vaishnavas. That's a personal process. You know, this method of meditation is for those who can't do that. If you can't live with Vaishnavas, then go sit by yourself in a cave. Yeah, and watch the fireflies. I don't think it's recommended to look for these kinds. There was one story of a young lady who approached Prabhupada and said, "When I, you know, chant Hare Krishna, I see all these lights and things." And Prabhupada said, "That's okay. You just keep on chanting; it'll go away." Yeah. Okay, we have to go on to 12. Aprityavyaptejo nilake samuttite panchatmake yoga gune pravritte natasya rogo najarana mrityu praptasya yogagni mayam shariram. Okay, here now some more definite symptoms of advancement in meditation. When the yogi's body has become transformed by the fire of his meditation, the five elements of its composition, of the body's composition, earth, water, fire, air, and ether, there's a mistake here, not with, but will become exalted to a purer state and will display excellence of the qualities inherent in them. The yogi will no longer be subject to disease, old age, or death. So this is describing the physical, bodily perfection that one gains from yoga practice. By the power of yoga to purify and elevate one, one's physical existence gradually becomes dominated by the mode of goodness, sattva-guna. Just like a fever, although we don't like having a fever, it's actually a process by the body for driving out infection. So just like fire in the form of fever eliminates all kinds of diseases, in the same way yoga is like a purifying fire, the fire of tapas, of spiritual endeavor. It purifies one's consciousness and also one's physical existence. The physical aspects of one's existence become exalted. They assume the excellence of their functions. The fragrance of the element earth, the taste of water, the form of the light of visible form, the touch of air, the sound and ether, these as manifested in one's body become excellent. There is a verse from Srimad Bhagavatam that's on top of page 31 that echoes this rather closely. From the second canto, Tato Vishesham Patipadya Nirbhayas Tenatmanapo Nala Murtir Atvaran Jyotir Mayo Vayumupetya Kale Vaivatmanakam Brihadatma Lingam. This is describing the devotee or yogi leaving the universe, traveling through the different planetary systems. After reaching Satyaloka, the devotee is specifically able to be incorporated fearlessly by the subtle body in an identity similar to that of the gross body, and one after another he gradually attains states of existence from earthly to watery, fiery, glowing, and airy, until he reaches the ethereal stage. Okay, next verse. 13. Lagu tvam arogyam alolu tvam varna prasadam swara saushtavam cha gandakshubo mutra purisham alpam yoga pravittim pratamam vadanti. Lightness, good health, freedom from hankering, a shining complexion, clear voice, pleasant smell, and little passing of stool and urine. These are said to be early effects of success in yoga practice. So lightness means a lack of heavy feeling in the body. One doesn't become fatigued, doesn't become lack of momentum. Arogyam. There's not serious disease which would distract and disturb one's mind. His mind is not full of hankering and greed. This hankering or greed appears in two ways. One is simple desire for sense gratification. The other is more subtle. The neophyte yogi may be wanting to achieve some mystic perfection, some powers, so he can bring other people under control, influence other people, in order simply to earn money and reputation. This is a subtle kind of greed. that the yogi can be distracted by. Shining complexion. This is a manifestation of brilliant effulgence in one's bodily complexion, or else saumyatvam, gentle appearance. And the other symptoms are speech that is very pleasing, that will attract and inspire the affection of other people and relieve them from fear. An auspicious aroma that pleases the nose. And one will also, who's becoming advanced in meditation, will not pass too much excrement, because he's not eating too much. He's eating moderately, so he passes less. And his digestion power is strong, and his body uses almost completely everything he eats. There's little waste from his digestion. So one comment made in a similar context from the Bhagavatam, 11th canto, description of mystic powers, of symptoms like this, described by Krishna, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, commenting on them, says that these perfections are attractive and amazing to immature people, not to those who are actually wise. They're not so much impressed by these things. Okay. 14th verse. Any questions? Yes, please.
Just one special question is that when we hear the encounter of the Yasadev and the two wives of his half brothers, when he has to go on Bika and Bani, it's not quite what
Yes. Well, okay, these are typical symptoms of somebody who's making gradual advancement, a sadhaka. But these rishis like Vyasadeva, they've been advanced sages for a long time. You know, they look like they do because they're very old, thousands or millions of years old. So it's typical that the great sages are not physically beautiful, or not, they don't have young bodies and they don't look beautiful. It doesn't say that if you're not becoming prettier and prettier, that you're not making advancement. It just says that this is, if you see an improvement in your physical existence, this is a symptom that you are making advancement. No guarantee that you won't get sick and you won't get old. Yes, I'm sorry?
You spoke that the yogi will no longer be subject to disease or disease.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, not that there will never be disease, certainly not that there won't be death, but an advanced yogi, one who's actually got some yogic power, he won't have to leave his body when he's not ready to. His death will be voluntary. You know, an advanced yogi controls when he leaves his body. And he more or less avoids, he's healthy most of the time. I mean, the body is always diseased. We're always feeling little pains, and we're always coughing and sneezing. You know, there is no ideal health in anybody. Okay, 14. Yataiva bimbam midayopaliptam dejomayam rajate tatsudantam tadvatma tatvam prasamikshya dehi
Eka quitarto bhavate vita shoka.
Just as an image made of clay, a statue made of clay, radiates attraction after it is painted, so the embodied soul, who has realized his own self, directly shines in his true glory. Only that person is successful in life, freed from all sorrow. And now we're starting to talk about the person who's reaching success. So how the practitioner realizes Brahman and the fruit of that realization are beginning to be described here. When the jiva is rid of his contamination of avidya, of ignorance, his misidentification with matter, when he's freed from that, then his spiritual identity begins to become revealed, to the extent, as you gradually realize you're not this body, and you're not a product of Maya, you don't belong to Maya, then you begin to realize who you really are. As, for example, there may be some object made of gold or silver, or jewels, but it may be covered with mud. So you have to clean it. You have to, if the mud has become hard, you can a goldsmith can use fire to purify gold from things that are mixed with it. That is this word, sudantam. That can be translated as smelting, as applying fire to metal to purify, to remove the pure ore from the mixtures. So similarly, the spirit self practices, cultivates knowledge of the Supreme. And that knowledge is like a fire that melts the contaminations. They run off like the impure things in the gold alloy. And then his real internal spiritual nature becomes gradually revealed. When he realizes himself in this way, he becomes self-realized. He becomes what is called Eka in this verse. I translated it as he alone is the person who is successful in life. But another, according to one of the commentaries, he becomes alone. He becomes isolated from the various material conceptions created by ignorance. He becomes separate from matter. Ekaha. That means to say that he becomes purified and free from fear. Kritartha, meaning successful, is a compound word from krita and artha. His artha, his goals in life, are achieved, krita. And a yogi, his intention, his goal in life, is to destroy his bondage of illusion. That's what he's aiming at. So that's the fruit, and he becomes also free from fear. From specifically the fear of material entanglement. Okay. Do the next verse, 15. Yadatma tatvena tu brahma tatvam. Dipo pameneha yukta prapashyed ajam druvam sarvatatvair vishuddham gyatva devam mujyate sarvapashahi. You should recognize this last line. It's the second time it's come up. And we'll see it at least once in every chapter except for the fifth, the same line repeated. Gyatva deva mujyate sarvapashahi. Translation. By first realizing one's own self, one can come to realization of the Supreme. In the same way as a lamp is used to show other things. Then the yogi fixed in meditation can directly see the unborn, unchanging Lord, who is free from the restrictions of material laws. Knowing that effulgent Lord, one is freed from bondage. That line that's repeated. Knowing that effulgent Lord, one is freed from bondage. That is more or less the basic theme of the whole Upanishad. By knowledge of the personality of Godhead, one becomes liberated. And of course, we understand the way things are described. That knowledge means devotional meditation, not just some dry or theoretical knowledge. So by practicing meditation, by hearing and chanting, or engaging in the Ashtanga Yoga system, one gradually comes, and that serves as a means to gradually realizing the Supersoul. But first, one has to realize himself as part and parcel of the Supersoul. Self-realization, realize of yourself, the jiva, is the means to realizing the Supreme Self. First, you have to realize yourself as spirit, then you can understand the Supreme Spirit. The example is given, just like scientists who want to study the ocean, they can't bring the whole ocean into their laboratory. It doesn't fit. They can go out into the middle of the ocean, drop a rope or some chain and pick up a small sample from the bottom of the ocean, a bottle of water, and bring that to the laboratory. And they study the sample, and they see all the things inside this bottle of water. Like that, you can study yourself. Understand what it means to be spirit. And by understanding the sample, you begin to know something about the whole. That's an example given by Jiva Goswami in the Sandarbhas. That's what's being described here. The knowledge of the self, atma-tattva, knowledge of your own self, is like a lamp that illuminates brahma-tattva. Just like a lamp shows other, I can see the page on the book because the lamp is on. It's a means to enlightenment. When you finally see the Supreme, the yogi, if he's practiced properly, and he's not an envious impersonalist, a Mayavadi, then eventually he'll see the Supersoul, and he'll recognize this is the Supreme Person. He'll see the Lord with his weapons and his ornaments. It says, seeing the commentator, Rangva Manuja says, when one sees the Lord thus, just like perceiving a jewel that has been hidden inside a cloth, one is then, at that time, freed from all this karmic entanglement, all this bondage. That is, if the person is a sincere practicer who has been following the proper process without envy and without duplicity. Those who are envious and are hardcore impersonalists, even if they come to the point of seeing the Supersoul, they may not recognize him properly. They may see Lord Narayan in their heart and think that they're seeing themselves. Oh, this is me, with forearms and these weapons. So they can become deluded, remain deluded, even at that point, if they're not sincere. The reason why we don't see Brahman in general is because of the ignorance covering the heart, the dust on the mirror of the heart. So just like in the material world, without sunlight or some lamp, some source of illumination, we can't see things in front of us. The most common things in our life we can't see. Even if we're in our own house, if the lights go out, we probably can't freely walk around without bumping into things. We need some light to see what is there. Similarly, practically speaking, you cannot realize Brahman, the Absolute Truth, without first realizing yourself. Realizing basically that you are a pure spirit, not this body. So we have to understand the difference between Brahman and the jiva. Otherwise, if we meditate and meditate and we see the Supersoul, but we don't understand the difference between the Supersoul and the jiva soul, we'll think that we're looking at ourselves. So therefore, it's described here, the difference. The Supreme Soul is Ajam, Dhruvam, Sarvatattvaya Vishuddham. He's unborn. That's a description of a difference, because we know. We may not know what the Supersoul is, but we know ourselves. We know our own material identity. We know that we're subject to material debt. You know, it said that nothing is certain in this world but taxes and death. We know that we're going to die. We've seen everybody else die, and we're seeing ourselves approach death. So the Supersoul is not subject to death. It's not born and doesn't die. By knowing that, we understand the difference between God and ourselves. Because he has a transcendental body. Our body is conditioned and material. The Supreme is Dhruvam. That means he's constant. Meaning that his identity, his personality doesn't transform, it doesn't change. He's always the same. And he's not ever overcome by sorrow and bewilderment. Whereas in contrast, we know from our own experience day to day, we're constantly experiencing the transformations of material happiness and distress from one minute to the next. We're happy and then we're miserable. We should understand the difference then. Sarva-tattvaya vimuktam, vishuddham. He's free from the taint, the contamination of any material element. Whereas the jiva, we're contaminated by so many material influences. Especially by material desire, hatred, and so on. These emotions. But the Lord is Devam. He's the source of all spiritual effulgence. He's the maintainer of all conscious beings. Nityo nityanam chetanas chetananam. The one living being who's maintaining everybody else. That is what the word Deva describes. So knowing ourselves as partial spirit, small spirit, and knowing the Supreme as the complete spirit, by that knowledge we can be favored by his grace. He'll be pleased with us, and we'll be freed from all the entanglements of birth and death and all the desires that keep us in illusion. Duality is the real message of the scriptures. The difference between the jiva and the Supreme. Not the sameness. Not all is one. But God is one thing and we're another thing. There's a difference. That is essential teaching of the Upanishads. Okay. Two more verses. Finish this chapter. The next verse is directly from the Yajurveda, 32nd chapter of the White Yajurveda. I'm going to try to chant it with the Vedic intonations.
Esha hi deva padisho nusarvaha purvoho hi jata sahugarbhe antaha sa eva jata sa janishamanaha pratyanjanas tishtati vishvato mukaha.
Okay, I hope I didn't get any intonation wrong. I don't want to create some demon in chanting. But anyway, that's something like it's supposed to sound like. The Lord occupies all the directions. He was born before all else, took birth again in the womb of the cosmos, and indeed will be born again in the future. He manifests to all within, residing in their hearts. His faces are turned everywhere. Vishvato Mukaha. So here we're changing our focus. We're not talking about our own spiritual practice. We're talking about the goal, the object of meditation, the Supreme Person. He's the real focus of attention here. Jana is one way of translating the first words in the last line, or that word Janaha. I translated, he manifests to all people, he manifests to all. But the word Jana can be considered an address. The sages are talking to each other. O sages. So the Lord said that he was born before everyone else, because he expanded himself as Brahma. He was the first living being born in the universe is a direct expansion of Lord Vishnu. So Vishnu himself took birth in the form of Brahma. And he's still taking birth now in the form of each living being who takes birth in this world is an expansion of the Supreme. And this universe will be annihilated and created again all over again. And the Lord will again expand as Brahma and then all the living entities in the future. This process will continue. So he was born before everybody else. He took birth again in the womb of the cosmos because he was present as in his, himself as Narayan before the creation. In the beginning of creation, he then took birth in the universe as Garbhadakshay Vishnu and then Brahma from the navel of Garbhadakshay Vishnu. And he'll do this again in the future. We know Brahma has his heads turning in four directions. Super soul, manifesting as the universal form, his heads are turning in infinite directions. He has thousands of heads facing all directions. Okay, someone may object. Well, isn't this a description of the universal form, not the Supreme Person, but this material form of the universe? And the answer is no. The Supreme Lord alone is the original person. He is the actual universal form. It's his form. He appears to take birth as the Virat Rupa. How is it that it's questioned? Can the Lord expand himself in all these different ways? How can he pervade everything? The answer is Vishvato Mukaha, which one explanation given in the commentary is means that he has his potencies, his energies, infinite energies expanding everywhere. He has his achintya shakti, inconceivable energies, by which he pervades and controls everything. Okay. Then the last verse in this chapter. Again, this verse is glorifying, offering praise of that Supreme Person, who is the object of meditation. Yo devo agnao yo apsu yo vishvam bhuvanam avivesha ya oshadishu yo vanaspatishu tasmai devaya namo namaha. Our repeated obeisances to him, the Lord in fire, the water, the herbs, and the great trees, who entered and pervades this entire world. So, this statement, this offering of praise of the Lord, who is present in all the phenomena of nature, which ends with offering obeisances, namo namaha, implies that this process of upasana, of meditation on the Lord as a form of worship, actually is a process of atma-samarpana, of surrendering oneself, of self-surrender. It's not different from devotional service. This process is successful when it's executed with faith and with tattva-gyan, knowledge of the essential truth of the Supreme, the reality of the material world and the spiritual existence. When you have faith and tattva-gyan, then you can be successful in meditation. And then you can have personal realization of the Supreme. He's present in fire because he's the super soul of all the material elements, including fire. The Brahmins are recommended to worship the sacred fire because that fire is a manifestation of the Lord's power, his effulgence. Similarly, he's present in his various opulent expansions, like the taste in water. He's entered everything in the world. He's in the herbs, like rice, barley, other growing herbs. He protects them while they're growing and gives them their nutritious and medicinal potencies. Aham, Krishna says himself. What is it? Somo bhutva dasatma. Pushnami chaushadi sarva. Somo bhutva dasatmakar. I expand as the moon god, and I give the juice of life to all the growing vegetables. Krishna says in the Gita. He says, the sage here says that Lord is present in the great trees. So, vanaspati can be understood as trees in general. But if literally, technically, the word vanaspati, that means literally the kings of the masters of the forest, the great rulers, the great best, you know, the prominent, most prominent trees in the forest. And technically that's defined as trees that give fruit but not flowers. You know, within Vedic botany, that's which trees are vanaspatis. Trees that don't give flowers but do give fruits. But by implication, all sorts of plants, even grass and shrubs, are implied here. He maintains, sustains the power of growth of all this vegetation. So here, repeated obeisances are offered to that Supreme, the Supreme Person, who is the upholder of the universe and all its aspects. And when you offer obeisances with the word namas, nam means to bow down. I bow down. I offer obeisances. This expresses recognition that this other person is superior to yourself. That's why you offer obeisances. And that's what you're expressing. This is an indication of self-surrender. And that the object that you're offering obeisances to deserves being meditated on. Okay, any questions? Okay, general question. Yes, we're really immortal, but we're experiencing death. So to be immortal means not to die. If you're immortal, why are you dying? Yeah, but we're identifying with the body. That's the problem, is that we're covered by illusion, and we think we're this body, we think we're dying. Yeah, that's why you don't have to turn the universe upside down to become free. You don't have to become Hiranyakashipu and take over the universe. You just have to become self-realized. Uncover, get rid of all this ignorance, realize who you are, and you'll be liberated, because you actually are immortal anyway. Shrinvantu aye amitasya putta. Did we read that verse yet? Yeah, I think so. Listen, all sons of immortality, you are sparks of the immortal supreme. You are also immortal. Yeah. Anything else? Yes, sir.
Interesting in that in the verse 1:9, it refers to the Supreme Personality and to the unborn.
Both are unborn. And no, three. There are three unborns. Material nature is also unborn.
Right. And then in 2:16, it refers that he was born for us.
Okay, but that's the apparent birth. God is not born every time he creates the universe. Not that there wasn't any God, and he came into existence at that time. He just plays his pastime of appearing in a certain body. And so do we. But our pastime is not our sport, it's our karma. Yeah, we're doing it, we're not enjoying it, and we're doing it against, you know, out of our control. But we're also pretending to take birth. But we're convinced of this. We believe it. We think we're taking birth and dying. But we're eternal, and nature is also eternal.
Is our taking birth, you know, it's according to our karma, is that a part of the pastime of the world?
Only one pastime, the pastime of creating and maintaining the material world. But no, for us, it's our. Ignorance and entanglement. Our real pastime is, each of us has an individual eternal relationship with the Lord, and we're neglecting that, you know, rotting in the material world. We shouldn't call that our pastime. It's the wrong pastime. That's, yeah. If you're here on a mission for the Lord, then that's your spiritual pastime.
But the only thing is, he's, when you're first, the Lord, he said he's born before all else. So is that referring to his eternal form, or is that referring to some haughty dedication?
It refers to the Lord taking on the form of the Purusha, Mahavishnu, the three Vishnus. Those Vishnus are asleep. He wakes up. It's not that he wasn't existing, but he was asleep during the period of annihilation. He wakes up. That's like his taking birth, when Mahavishnu wakes up. And then from him expands. Garbhadakshaya Vishnu was not manifest during that period. And at the beginning of creation, after all these different universes come out of the body of Mahavishnu, then there's a new expansion from inside of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu into each universe. That's like his birth, like Garbhadakshaya's birth. Garbhadakshaya Vishnu takes birth in the water of the universe, covering half the universe, which is like the womb. Garbha means womb. So it's like inside the egg of the universe, the water sitting in that egg is like the birthplace of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. That's why it's called Garbha Ocean, or womb ocean. That's his birthplace. The way it appears. That's the pastime. Now we're starting the third chapter. In the third chapter, the Absolute Truth is given a name, and his glories are further elaborated on. So, first verse.